for playing baseball. The kind of weather makes a man hit like hell.
Good evening and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. My name is James Marino, and it is Monday, May 18th, 2009. Joining us this evening is Peter Felicia. You can read Peter Felicia in his columns three times a week at theatermania.com and at the Star Ledger. Also with us is Matthew Murray, who is the chief theater critic for Talkin' Broadway and a Broadway Stars columnist. How are you guys doing this evening?
So far, so good.
Not too bad.
Excellent. So we're, what would you call it, Peter, in the, when we're in the middle? We're in the intermezzo?
Awards hell, you mean? Is that what
yes. We're in the entree.
No, let's say awards heaven. It's a nice time of year. It really is. It may even be the most wonderful time of the year in many respects, and certainly a time of year when many people will always remember what happened to them in May and June. So, let's concentrate on the good things that happen as a result of awards, that business can go up as a result of them, and people get a kick out of checking off which awards winners or nominees they've seen. I've had plenty of people say to me, I saw all four musical nominees this season. You know, so it means a lot to people and to the fans as well as to the people, of course, who are the recipient of the nominations and the awards.
So, Matthew, if Peter's on the comedy side, are you on the tragedy side?
No, not particularly. I think that it is a really interesting time of the year, and there's a lot of energy and excitement, even if you don't particularly care about the outcome of this race or that race. There's so much happening, and everyone is paying so much attention to theater, mostly in New York, of course, but really all over the country right now, that you're united with other people in a way you might not be most of the time. So I think it's a great time of the year, too.
You know, that united thing brings up a good point. One of the best things about going to an awards ceremony, be it the Drama Desk or the Tonys or even the Theater World Awards on June 2nd at 2 p.m., is the fact that you're with a group of people who care. You really feel that no one is alone when you're in that group, that the people who care about the stuff you care about are there right with you. And while many of us do grow up feeling a little disenfranchised from other people we know because we care about theater and many people don't, you certainly can't tell it when you're in Radio City Music Hall or at LaGuardia High School Auditorium or at the Friedman Theater where the Theater World Awards will be. So it's just a nice feeling of camaraderie.
All righty. So one of the award ceremonies that happened, I guess, yesterday, Sunday, was the Drama Desk Awards. Now, Peter, you and Matthew are both Drama Desk voters?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Peter's the a past president of Drama Desk?
Yeah, I did it from 93 to 96, 4 years.
And Matthew, you were a voter this year, but in previous years you've in a previous year, you were a nominator?
That's correct.
Excellent. I've read all your bios. Excellent. So what did you think of this year's awards?
Pretty much the same that I feel about every year. The Drama Desk takes great pride in saying, you know, we represent Broadway and off-Broadway. And it is true. You can
and
see that.
Theoretically off-Broadway as well.
And theoretically.
As long as it runs more than 17
performances. Right. The thing is, of course, that while the nominations do pay heed to off-Broadway, it's a rare show that winds up getting a Drama Desk Award that originates off-Broadway and stays off-Broadway. There are exceptions to every rule, and certainly Ruin this year did very well in getting that Best Play nod. But, of course, Ruined has the pedigree of the Pulitzer Prize. So as a result, that one was not too easy to ignore. But I'll tell you, when I was Drama Desk president, I was in on the voting. I was there with the accountant. He and I would look at each ballot and see the way people were voting. And the reason I bring this up is, theoretically, you could say, well, Billy Elliot won Best Musical yesterday, and that's very nice. But maybe it beat out an off-Broadway musical by a vote or two. It has been my experience in 4 years of counting ballots and looking at ballots that most of the balloters, the voters, vote for Broadway shows no matter what. It's an astonishingly disproportionate number. And it's very sad that that has to be the case. And I really came to the conclusion that many Drama Desk voters are there for the big events, that they want to make sure that they get in to see the great big Broadway shows. And I think they're a little less interested, or maybe a lot less interested, in going more far afield into nooks and crannies to see the shows. This is not true of the nominators, of course, who do an excellent job in getting here, there, and most everywhere. But in terms of the voters, I think a lot of them really are just there to get the cherries on the top of the sundaes.
Well, you know, these the nominators you're speaking of are all critics, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Drama Desk is a critics organization.
And the Drama Desk is a critics organization. And how many voting members are there, do you think?
Well, I know there was 166 when I was doing it. I don't know what it is now.
I think that the number is roughly the same. I don't know exactly the number, but
I would think
close
it would
to that.
Be. Yeah.
So you're talking about, and the nominating committee is in the 20s, or?
No, the nominating committee is six or seven people. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize it was so small.
Yeah. The Lortel Awards, on which I'm a nominator, is 20 people, which is really something. I think that's
the Tony Awards are 27, I believe.
Yeah, so it's a big group. But yeah, Drama Desk is, I agree with Matthew, six or seven.
So we're talking about... you're talking about six or seven people who are going to put together this list of the of the nominees, and then 160 or so voters out there that are going to vote in each of these categories. We always get into this during every season about how audiences say and producers say that they don't agree with the critics. So do you think that the Drama Desk Awards kind of goes, you could predict them by putting all the reviews down side by side?
Oh, what a good observation. I guess there's something to be said for that.
A correlation between reviews and the Drama Desk winners?
Yeah, I guess so. The thing is, I get the feeling that many of the Drama Desk voters are people who don't review most every show. I think that they work for publications that are quite selective. It always amazed me at the Star Ledger how Michael Summers, the New York critic there, would go into these nooks and crannies, these small places, sometimes with really, I'm serious, like 50 seats. And he would write this, you know, 17-inch review, you know, 600 words, and would treat it as a major event. I'm not quarreling with that. What I am saying is I never thought that there would be too many people from New Jersey who would go into New York for a night on the town to see such shows. I always thought that people from New Jersey coming in wanted to see more high-profile shows. So my hat was off to Michael for really doing an extensively good job of covering theater in New York. However, I think he was the exception, and most people who cover theater in New York cover Broadway and are far less concerned with what's happening off Broadway, unless, of course, it looks like it has great potential, and then they'll jump on the bandwagon.
Could you tell us some of the off-Broadway shows that might have been well represented in the Drama Desk in the past?
You mean in the years that I was doing it? What?
Well,
what
yeah, drama, you know, what, if I'm just pulling out of the air, did Wit play off Broadway at the Darryl Roth?
Wit never came to Broadway, right?
Yeah. So
and that was certainly one that did win. What I remember so vividly, I remember when Rent was happening. That was the last year I did it, and I was hoping, in fact, that Rent wouldn't make the move until the following season, because I thought it would be nice if the Drama Desk could recognize an off-Broadway musical as the superior musical of that year. You know, of course, they got to Broadway awfully quickly with the momentum they had, not only from the good reviews, but God rest to soul Jonathan Larson's death. There was no stopping that train from happening sooner rather than later. But I was really hoping that it would happen. The only the one that I remember getting votes that it really won handily, this just comes to mind immediately, was Mary Louise Wilson's show, Full Gallop, about Diana Vreeland, the fashion editor. And I and it's funny because I remember Diana Vreeland used to like to say, I, and indeed, that's what Mary Louise Wilson said when she won her Drama Desk Award. She was so excited. Maybe she knew that the Drama Desk Awards were often skewered in Broadway's favor.
Well, it makes sense that the critics who are voting tend to see a lot more in the Broadway fair than the off-Broadway fair, or even the off-off-Broadway fair. Matthew, you've been unsuspectingly quiet here.
Let me pay tribute to Matthew for being a critic who gets out there and sees everything. So he's one of the good
Matthew,
guys.
What's your play count total this year?
I'm a little behind in updating my database, so I can't tell you.
You'd have
but
to kill
me. I'm doing okay. I think I must be getting pretty close to the 3-digit range there. I don't think I'm past it yet, but I have to be getting close.
You mean the 300 range, don't you?
No, not 300. That's
are you serious?
300 for the year? No way. It's too early.
You mean the calendar
no,
year?
No. You're talking calendar year. I'm talking about the Broadway season.
Season, right. I'm on
oh,
track.
Oh, for the season. Yeah. I don't count by the season. I count by the calendar year.
Okay.
So like I said, I'm behind. So
in 2008, how many shows did you go to?
252.
252 uh-huh. shows.
And I go by season. Last season, I did 360. And I'm on a pace to break that this year. That would be the highest ever. But again, that has to do with the fact that when I was in Edmonton at a festival, I saw 19 shows in like 72 hours. So that's what's going to put me higher this year if it goes higher. But of course, all mine on Broadway because I review in New Jersey. About 120, 130 of them are in New Jersey. I dare say Matthew sees more in New York than I do.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know about that, but
anyway, it's close. There's no question we're putting in the time, both of us.
So anyway, we got a little off on a little tangent there. You know, Billy Elliot is running away the way that people who saw the production in London a few years ago came back and said this is going to come to Broadway and this is going to win everything. It seems like this self-fulfilling prophecy is happening. And
well, it's interesting you say that, James, because I recall a lot of people at the time when Billy Elliot hit London saying this could never go in America. It's just too arcane and too British in scope.
I
Matthew, do you recall
too.
Hearing any of that? You do too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I seem to recall that Michael Riedel wrote multiple columns about the trouble that people were having with it and the fear that no one would know who Margaret Thatcher was, that the mining strike would not really resonate with Americans unless to be Virginia or something like that.
Yeah, and it's very nice that it's done well, that those didn't turn out to be handicaps at all.
Yeah, you know, well, it's good that we didn't rewrite Les Mis to be a Pittsburgh coal miner town.
That's
either.
Right.
So, and it's good that, you know, a good portion of Broadway's summer audience is Europeans.
But speaking of the Drama Desk Awards and speaking of Billy Elliot, I found it very interesting to find that they wouldn't allow the nominators, am I correct, Matthew, to go to see all three Billies? Did
well,
you hear that?
My understanding of what happened was, and I believe that we covered this in a previous podcast, was that the producers of Billy Elliot wanted all three of the boys to be considered as a single unit. But the Drama Desk was not willing
that what it was?
To. No,
okay.
What it was is the producers of Billy Elliot were willing to give the nominators tickets to see the other Billies that they didn't see. My understanding is that a majority of the nominators saw Kiro Kulish, and the producers wanted them to go back and see the other Billies only if they were willing to consider all of the Billies as one performance. And the Drama Desk was not willing to accommodate this. So as a result, the Billies were not nominated.
Wow. Now, so this was really their decision. And that's a curious one to me. I mean, for the Theatre World Awards, we decided that we would see all three. And I know Matthew did, and I know I did, and I know Harry Hahn did, and I know Frank Scheck did. I mean, you know, so it was something that was very near and dear to us to go. I like Billy Elliot. I saw it in London. I didn't, quote unquote, need to see it three times for my own enjoyment. But nevertheless, I thought it was something I should do. And
see,
I'm very surprised. Yes, right. And I'm very surprised to hear that the Drama Desk nominators, you should pardon the expression, couldn't be bothered. Is that what we're saying?
No, I don't blame the Drama Desk nominators for this. I don't think it's their problem. I think that the Drama Desk board didn't want to be constrained to choosing one nomination for all of these. And this really goes to my personal feelings about the issue, especially with regards to the Tony nominations, is that if I were a nominator of one of these award shows, I can say from having seen all three, I did not think that all of the Billies were created equal. And if I were forced to choose between having none or giving the award to all three, I believe I would also choose none, because I don't necessarily believe that every single one of those young men is worthy of a best performance in a musical award. Now, they're all very talented dancers and they all do some things very well, but I think that that standard is very high and that not all of them necessarily meets it. So I actually think that the Drama Desk made the right choice here, but I do admit that it does look a bit weird for these three young men in collectively the biggest performance of the season and certainly one of the biggest shows to not be represented anywhere on the ballot at all. It looks weird, but I can't argue with the reasoning behind it.
So let me ask you, a couple of seasons ago, we were all falling over ourselves and nobody could get a ticket to the producers, who just swept everything in that season and has seemingly fell from grace pretty quickly after Nathan and Matthew left.
Right.
And it limped along. And do you think that Billy Elliot would fall into the same category, that it's being very hyped right now, it's the hot thing of the moment, or do you think it's got legs like Jersey Boys and Wicked?
Well, I personally think that this actually is related to what we were just talking about, and that it's a big part of the reason that the producers are being so very controlling about the way that the three Billy actors are being perceived. If it turns out that one astonishing performance from one of those kids becomes the show in people's minds, then when that kid leaves, and they're all going to have to eventually, because they're all getting taller, they're all getting older, their voices are all on the verge of changing if they haven't started already. If that happens, then the show might go the way of the producers, which was so closely identified with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick that it couldn't really survive different interpretations. And I use that term loosely, since the producers only got really two interpretations that were then filtered through other actors. So I think it's wise from that standpoint. I have to say, though, that unless the Tonys do something really magical for the show, I don't see it even being a I don't see it ever being the same kind of phenomenon that the producers was. Now, that doesn't mean it won't run longer. It's possible that it could, but I think that it's not ever going to be the hot must-have sell your kids for money to get a ticket kind of show. I don't think it's ever going to be that.
Well, I agree with that, but I will say that the difference for the producers was the fact that Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick were famous already. And as a result, they were household names, at least to the Broadway community. And when they left, the luster left with them. I dare say that there are many, 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 many theater fans who enjoy the Broadway musical who could not begin to tell you all three Billy Elliot's names, or even maybe even one of them. And as a result, I don't think that whoever plays that part, the name is going to matter. All that's going to matter if the kid is good or not. And I think, you know, the fact is, with a kid, you know, it's a very demanding role, God knows. To carry a show on your shoulders like that, where you have to do so much dancing and a good deal of singing and a bit of acting as well, I think people come in giving kids the benefit of the doubt anyway when kids perform. And as a result, I think most people are going to come away and say, Jesus, that kid was terrific.
So let me back up and talk about a larger overarching issue in the trend on Broadway. You know, we had, of course, you know, the British invasion with the Phantoms and Les Mis and Starlight Express and that whole genre that happened in that time. Mm-hmm. That those shows seem to run forever, and now we have the big winners. I'm trying to think of other big winners. I'm thinking of producers that won everything and a couple of seasons later closed, and then we have Spamalot, which also won a tremendous amount of awards. And also is not with us anymore, as those big British shows, you know, Phantom at least is still running.
Well, I have a theory on this, and I could be wrong, but nevertheless, it seems to me that the shows that are funny don't get the repeat business as shows that are serious and have emotional pull. Once you hear the jokes, it's over. So I think that many of the, even Jekyll and Hyde had so much repeat business, which really kept it around much longer than many people would have thought, given the reviews and, to be frank, the quality of the material. But nevertheless, it does seem that once you've heard the jokes, you go home, and that's the end of it. It was a pleasant night out. God love it. But you don't feel compelled to see the funny shows as much as you want to see the serious emotional shows.
Well, do you see it as maybe being a little bit different along the lines of audience type? I mean, is the producers and Spamalot really a kind of a guy show, a male show, and like Phantom and Les Mis kind of more of a female show, and guys don't repeat and women do?
Well, or,
I mean,
maybe,
not certainly,
but
we're,
you know,
not anthropologists here, but
the thing about Billy Elliot, it is about a boy fighting against his father, and I think a lot of guys can relate to that, no matter what the issue is. Fathers and sons, Lord knows, have a lot of issues, and under those circumstances, I think that could help Billy to run more than many shows where there wasn't that emotional pull. Because all of us, boy, is there anyone who really hasn't wanted to do something that his parent didn't want him to do, especially to make a living? That's a very common theme in American life, it seems to me. So I think that's going to help the show continue.
Almost as though Arthur Miller wrote Billy Elliot.
Yeah, in a sense. You know, and one of the things, of course, those English shows had for them was when Andrew Lloyd Webber was tremendously hot. And he really was coming out with good material during that period of time. But this is Elton John, who is no stranger to the ticket-buying public either. And I think that must help Billy Elliot to some degree.
Well, I mean, on the flip side of that, using that type of logic, then the producers of Spider-Man made a good choice with
Bono
and The Edge to write the music.
Maybe. So, I don't know if any decision is smart, though, with a $40 million musical, but, you know, we'll see.
That's true.
That's a lot of money.
That's
Garth. That's more than a lot of money.
That's Garth Drabinski money, you know.
Yeah, if you were really behind it. You know? Anyway, go on.
Kind of interesting, the Michael Riedel's article about Alan Cumming. Alan should hold out for big money, because what's big money in a Broadway show when the budget is $40 million and the director really wants you?
He's got a point.
Yeah, I have to tell you that I'm.
But good Lord, the problem, of course, is going to be that obviously tickets are going to be substantially higher. And the problem whenever there's a ticket increase is that every other Broadway show has to feel that it must raise its prices too. Because what? You think you're better than we are?
But
no, you're not.
Sometimes that won't work. And I think we talked about this briefly in another podcast about how the Miss Saigon toyed with the $100 tickets in the very beginning when they were opening in was Saigon open in
91.
And they toyed with the $100 ticket up front, and it kind of fell on its face. And the producers toyed with the $400 tickets, and that fell flat on the face. So the market will, you know.
But obviously they have to raise prices if it's going to be a $40 million show.
They have to.
I won't even be surprised if it's a quantum leap. I won't even be surprised if it's $200.
I think that would be interesting to see how they would market that. I think that if they're going to do a $40 million show, they have to break the rules of Broadway. And we've talked about we've talked off the air about this, but not really on any of the podcasts about, you know, why is there 8 shows a week? Why can't there be 10 shows a week? Why 12 shows a week? And why can't there be multiple casts? And why can't there be, you know, the same show open into 2 different theaters across the street from each other? And a lot of people would say, that's just crazy talk. And, well, why? Well, you know, why is there a Wednesday matinee? Why is Wednesday any different than Tuesday or Thursday? And
The Wednesday matinee, I think, has outlived its usefulness because it certainly came about in a time when women were staying at home, and one day a week they used to go out to the theater, and it was considered a nice treat. But the average woman today is not doing nothing on a Wednesday. She's at work. So as a result, it's one of the reasons when Tommy opened, the Who's Tommy, the ticket demand was really intense, but not for Wednesday matinees.
Yeah. And
it was astonishing how that was their weakest performance. Because indeed, you should pardon the expression, little old ladies did not want to go see the Who's Tommy. And the little old ladies were the only ones who could go to Wednesday matinee. Oh, yeah, of course, an occasional tourist and what have you who's in town. But to depend on a Wednesday matinee audience.
So is, you know, would you think that a Spider-Man could do a 7 and an 11 performance at night? You know, if Spider-Man's going to go for that young audience that goes to midnight movies, would they...
Yeah, I think there should be much more creativity in Broadway scheduling. I feel that I'm not sure that the schedule we have is archaic, but I certainly will say that it amazes me that people don't try more. Years ago, there was a play called The Apple Doesn't Fall on Broadway. It was about a mother-daughter relationship, and what it was the daughter was coping with her mother who had Alzheimer's disease. And I remember meeting with the playwright and saying to her, you know what really should happen here? Because this is a play about grown daughters and their aged mothers, I think you'd be wise to do Wednesday and Saturday evenings and all your other shows just do matinees. Because I think there are people who do want to come in from the suburbs to see a show who don't want to be in New York late at night. And if it's your audience, if that's your target audience, you know, older women, why not do more matinees? It amazes me that people don't try it.
Yeah, I think that the schedule works for a lot of things, but certainly they try to apply it across the board to every show, and I think that is more of an inertia to the theater culture, and also
it is inertia. I can't tell you how many shows I've seen in London in which I have had no interest whatsoever, simply because they were playing at a time when no other show was playing. I went.
I mean,
I'd
that's the whole
something than nothing. You know,
you can see just amazing shows at any of these fringe festivals. You know, if you go to Fringe over in Edinburgh,
or in New York, for that
matter. New York, you can pick up a great show.
Yes, but my point is that I saw Mac and Mabel at a Tuesday matinee in London.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've seen plenty of shows at 5 o'clock on Friday.
And aside from the theater inertia. The Broadway culture inertia that wouldn't let the changes is that so many union rules that are in place that, you know, whether it's stagehands or AFM or Equity or, you know, any number of unions down the line there, it gets dicey to try and get people to give exceptions to these things.
Sure.
You think of what the Dodgers went through with trying to schedule Christmas Carol.
Right.
You know, when Christmas Carol was doing just crazy weeks. I think at the most they did a 14-show week, or I don't know if they did more than 14 shows, or maybe they did.
I remember running into Walter Willison one January afternoon. He threw out his arms wide and said, "I'm out of prison." And I thought, my God, what did this actor do that he was in prison? And what he meant was he was in Christmas Carol and, you know, he had to do all those shows. And, you know, I mean, I just thought this was, you know, some terrible thing that he had done, God forbid. But I mean, you know, it was my first thought. But for an actor to refer to a good paying job as prison, you know, I mean, it really says something.
It was interesting. Actually, Walter took me to go see the reading of A Christmas Carol. And there was only 4 or 6 actors in the whole thing. And to see it from its genesis and 4 or 6 actors sitting around a table reading this and singing some of the songs to seeing that big spectacle that ended up at Madison Square Garden was they had to do 14 shows a week and keep everybody on the hook there to pay for it because that was quite a lavish set.
It reminds me of an evening in 1977 when I went up to Mary Lee Johnson's apartment, the Johnson & Johnson heiress, to go to a backers audition of On the 20th Century that Betty and Adolph were going to actually do with Cy Coleman. Betty fell ill, and as a result, Willie Burke, who had a small role in the eventual production, played her part. But I guarantee you, if Betty and Adolph had done it on the 20th Century with Cy Coleman playing the piano, it would have had to have been one of the great nights of my theater-going life. It was terrific anyway, but I mean, really, imagine Betty and Adolph playing those parts.
Okay, it's going to shock everybody, but we actually, I'm looking at my notes here, we went off on a wild tangent again.
No, never.
Yes, we did. We did. So I just wanted to get back to the drama desk for a few more minutes and then talk about some other things. But I'm looking at the drama desk, the winners here. I think that Pablo Schreiber was the only off-Broadway play to win an award. Is that true?
You're talking about a performer now, you know, because I mean, something like Celebrity Autobiography.
Oh, yes. Yeah, unique theater experience.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, Ruined won. But yeah, he was the only actor who from an off-Broadway show who was awarded.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I wonder how unless you also count Lorenzo Pizzoni in Humor Abuse, which is performance.
Right. Yeah. They tend to win in those categories, the off-Broadway shows.
It's tough for an off-Broadway show to compete in, you know, lighting and costume and things like where they just outstrip by magnitudes and budget.
In fact, I remember very vividly that Alexis Green, a critic for a number of publications, was the one in 95 or 6, I don't remember which year, but she was the one who said to the Drama Desk nominating committee, look, come on, you know, these sets and costumes and lighting awards, they always go to the musical. Can't we split the categories so that plays really get a chance? And that happened. And that really is a result of Alexis Green and the Drama Desk. Anyway, I'm not saying that necessarily impacted the Tonys to make a similar decision, but still, I want to give Alexis Green credit where credit is due. She's the one who suggested that.
And we were talking about the design categories, but David Korins won for Why Torture Is Wrong and the People Who Love Them at the Public Theater. And he was up against four other Broadway plays and one off-Broadway play. And whatever you think about Desire Under the Elms, and Lord knows I have extremely strong opinions about it, Walt Spangler devised an enormous, expensive-looking set for that. So I think that it's not impossible to get voters to look at an off-Broadway show and say, yes, there are some real design elements here that are amazing and that we need to honor, but it's very hard. Hmm. Very hard.
Well, I mean, technically, you know, I mean, one reason I think that many voters don't go off-Broadway, maybe they're tired of hearing press agents saying, I don't have the seats, because after all, we are talking with smaller spaces. So it's possible that people are getting turned down from going because they're just not the seats available. It's a numbers game, after all.
Yeah, that's true. Other than the actual awards for the Drama Desk, there seems to be a little drama behind the awards, and Matt Windham wrote in his blog in AM New York, kind of talked about how the Drama Desk has sort of lost its luster. And do you guys have any opinion either way on that?
It's a very hard award to have luster from the vantage point of its being in the shadow of the Tonys. It is interesting to me that the Golden Globes used to be, you should pardon the expression, a joke. And as the years have passed, they have not. They have become far more involved with the industry, and more people show up than before. So I saw that happening with the Drama Desk, and I wonder if it's peaked. I hope it hasn't. There is still something nice about it, and I wish it well. But I didn't see what Matt wrote, so you'll have to help me there as to what he wrote.
I can say a little bit about this, and I, James, if this is speaking out of turn, please tell me and edit it out. But I didn't read what he wrote on the AMNY blog, but he made a comment on Facebook about exactly that thing, where he noticed that a lot of the winners had simply not shown up to collect the awards. Now, you could argue that because Billy Elliot was winning stuff left and right and all those people are British, that perhaps that had something to do with it. They weren't even in the country. I don't know. But that seemed to me to see the point that he was making. And I don't know whether that's necessarily indicative of a problem with the Dramadesk not having the same respectability and allure that the Tonys do. That's true simply from the standpoint that because the Tonys are the big commercial awards and the ones that get all the attention, that you're not going to get the same devotion and the same sense of importance that you're going to otherwise. But the Dramatists are difficult for a lot of reasons, and for reasons I might not need to get into for our listening audience, I am really reluctant to say too much about what I think is going on with the organization as a whole. But I do think that there is a pattern of this kind of thing happening with issues that are not necessarily being addressed, with the awards ceremony itself maybe not always being as well attended as it has been. There are certainly problems with it not being broadcast on television anymore. And being
yeah, and
relegated.
I wonder why that happened. You know, I remember very vividly going up to New York One in 1996 to pitch this. Frankly, it was Randy Levine Miller, who still works with the organization, who got the meeting, and she went with me. But I remember very vividly saying to them, you know, what you're really getting is the Tony Awards, because you're going to get everybody who's nominated for a Tony Award there. In essence, it's just a different version of the Tonys. And I saw their eyes sparkle at that mention, and they said, yeah, right. The decision was made immediately in that meeting. Not, we'll get back to you, we'll think about it, I got to run it by my boss. None of that. We're doing it. And for 2 or 3 years, that was my last year, and it was the first year on TV. And for a few years, they did it. And I don't know why they lost interest. I can't say that. But it seemed to me a good deal to be able to go there and have that happen, because you were going to get most of the people there. So I don't know.
Well, as we leave the Dramadesk Awards and everybody gets prepared for the big kahuna, the Tony Awards, it was announced that Neil Patrick Harris is going to be our host for this year's awards. Any thoughts on that?
I find it refreshing. I mean, it's certainly a dark horse candidate as far as I'm concerned. But let's try something entirely different. And we've never had a host like this, have we?
Certainly not. I actually really like Neil Patrick Harris. I think he's a very talented stage actor. He's very good on film, and he was wonderful in the Dr. Horrible trilogy of plays, of strike plays that Joss Whedon came up with last year. Is that right? And so he's very talented, and he's got obviously audience members and devotees in all of the different media. I just question how exciting he's going to be.
That's fair.
Don't know whether that matters to mm-hmm. the people who are putting mm-hmm. on the Tonys or the people who are watching the Tonys or anything like that, but I don't see him drumming up quite the same energy that someone like Hugh Jackman did a couple of years ago. Now, the problem with the whole aspect of him doing it was addressed in kind of a roundabout way by Michael Riedel, who wrote an entire column about how Will Ferrell should do the Tonys, but they really wanted James Gandolfini, who didn't want to be portrayed as a song and dance man. And I guess I'm not entirely sure where this idea has come from, that the host really needs to be so intimately involved in every aspect of the performing on the Tonys. And in fact, I think it might almost be better if that weren't the case. I think that if the Tonys were to get a little bit classier and were to get a little bit more formal and were to get a little bit more quote-unquote emceed, so that there was really someone who was in charge and who was corralling the evening's entertainment into something else, I think that that might actually be better than having someone like Hugh Jackman or someone like Neil Patrick Harris or someone like Whoopi Goldberg or, God forbid, someone like Rosie O'Donnell taking over the show when maybe that's not what the audience really wants to see. We've spoken on other podcasts about how we think that maybe, since no one's ever going to watch the Tonys anyway, maybe they should do what's really right for the fans. And I don't know if Neil Patrick Harris singing and dancing or not is really right for the fans. Time will tell. I'm not convinced at this point. I would love to be proven wrong, though. And if anyone can do it, it could be him.
Well, I just think that it might be that the whole concept of the format of how we perceive what should happen in the show needs to change.
One consideration, certainly. I don't think there's any American who wouldn't welcome a different type of award show in whatever field he is most interested in, film or music or whatever.
It's just astounding to me that we have thousands upon thousands of professionals that work in the blocks that bound what we consider Broadway, putting on shows 8 times a week that are of utmost high quality. And at our big penultimate time, we blow it. Every year the Tony telecast is just atrocious. Mm-hmm. And I just come away every year saying, I just don't understand how we have all these professionals that all of a sudden we forget how to put on a show.
Well, is the problem, and this is actually a question because I don't know the answer, but is the problem really with the theater professionals themselves, or is it with the television professionals and never the twain shall meet? I realize that in the wake of Rosie Live, which was put together almost entirely by theater professionals, that we have to ask about whether the people who are writing and producing these things on the theater side are really the best choices.
Well, but I mean,
I don't know how much CPS really knows about putting on a great show for the theater, which is ultimately what the Tonys have to be.
I keep thinking of bad choices. Like, I can't think of.
Well, I can think of a lot of bad choices. This have to do with the camera work and the musical numbers and so on.
No, I'm thinking of. I mean, everybody sits through bad sketches, just wanting to get to the next category. I don't know why they just don't do the categories, do the big numbers from the shows, and be done with it. But there's so much stuff that is forced into the Tony telecast that makes it long and drawn out, and you know, it's reflected in the ratings every year. But yet still, Broadway producers swear by it and say that there's bumps in sales for all their any time they bring a performance on it. And this performance is getting a national, if not international, preview.
It also has a great deal to do with placement as well. Smokey Joe's Cafe did very, very well as a result of the show's opening with that song, they say, The Neon Lights Are Bright on Broadway.
Yeah.
It was a very exciting opening, and the next day the phones were really ringing, even though Smokey Joe's Cafe won very little, if anything. But it did the trick. Similarly speaking, in 1990, when Grand Hotel had its tremendous number, We'll Take a Glass Together, it was the first number that was on. And I guess the point is, you know, you can hold people for about 10 minutes with the Tonys. So whoever goes on first has the best chance of selling tickets the next day. But that number, of course, came across very well on TV, because for those who saw Grand Hotel was almost split. The stage was almost split in three equal parts, and We'll Take a Glass Together was centered in the center part, and as a result, that small space lent itself to the TV screen extraordinarily well. So things like that matter as well. They just do.
Well, and We'll Take a Glass Together is a very positive message, and it's a fun thing, and Michael Jeter was...
Yes.
Michael Jeter was just, you know, I think he won that year.
And that was interesting too, because he won immediately following that number and gave a very dramatic speech about being an addict and getting over it and giving hope to other people. And in fact, ABC, which after all does not cover the Tonys, made him the person of the week that Friday and ran that his acceptance speech, which was really something for another network to be so moved by it to take it on.
We're getting into the thick of it, so not next week, but the week after, which is June 1st, we're going to all get together with lots of people and talk about the Tony telecast, or the Tony nominations, and what will win and what should win, and our general thoughts about it. We want to invite everybody who's listening to this podcast to throw your hat in the ring and let your voice be heard too. So give us a call at 646-349-1031 and leave us a message about what your thoughts are on the upcoming Tony Awards. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray, I'd like to thank you all for listening this evening. And this is James Marino saying goodnight for This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Bye.